Anyhow, well, welcome everybody. I think what I'm going to just do for one moment, if you don't mind, is just to test my slides, just to see if I can share this. Is this okay? Can you all see a?
Yes.
Oh, great. Okay. So let's get started because I know we're going to lose a little bit of time. And I see that Louise is actually speaking in another session right now. So we'll have to be reassigned. Okay, so let me just see. Okay, well, I think I'll let him work it out. Anyhow, so welcome everybody. Thank you for joining this session. I'm very excited to have this session. It is a group effort by colleagues who've worked together during the COVID period and even produced an article in the middle of the pandemic. And now we have many more perspectives now that we're hopefully on the downside. And as I could say for Israel, today is our first day without masks. Hi, Louise, now we can see you. Great, so we're waiting for you to come in. So this is a celebratory day for my part of the world. And I hope you all are going to catch up with us as possible. So it is really my pleasure. And it's my honor to be introducing our speakers. And first, I'd like to introduce Titin Sentel from Hawaii, who will be giving us the introduction to our session. So Titin, can you hear me?
Sure, yes, thank you. Thank you, Diane.
So I'll push your slide. How's that? Is that okay?
Perfect.
Okay. There you go. That's Titin.
That's me.
But she's coming from Hawaii. It's really late for her right now. So we're gonna allow her to introduce and then get off to sleep. Go ahead, Titin.
Awesome, aloha. Thank you, Diane. Welcome everybody. Really wonderful to be with you today across all the distances to talk about this work that we did collaboratively over many distances in a very complicated time. And I was really honored to be part of this project. As Diane said, I got to go first since I may not be able to last the whole session, but I'm really pleased to really have a moment to set up the framework with which we did this work. And so this would be familiar, presumably for many of you, but is a really important framework around how we think about health promotion and implications and solutions and what that might look like. And so this is the social ecological model. And as you can see in the orange center, the ideas that our interpersonal, intrapersonal outcomes and our personal health well-being is really linked to a host of factors that surround us. This includes our interpersonal relationships, our family, our close friends, our spouses, our people close to us and around us in a very interactive way. Our institutional settings, schools, health centers, the organizations with which we interact and are organized, the communities that surround us, our neighborhoods, our homes, our environments within, and even our online communities, right? Our communities across space and time even that hold us together. And then policies that surround us and help support those, help build health within those settings or bring challenges to health, right? And so that certainly is local politics, local policy, but also national policy and international policy, right? We can really see the connectivities and importance of this across the moments of COVID-19. And so it was really exciting as we thought through health promotion and health literacy and what those initiatives were looking like in our different settings across COVID-19 to really think how they placed within understanding how these levels of the social ecological model might work together and also how they might be informed by one another and really thinking through solutions and best practices and how we can get better together and more helpful together in this complicated time. The next slide, please. Diane, if you're still there.
I'm trying to push it. And it, okay, 1 second. For some reason, it gets stuck for a moment.
Well, it's fine as it goes. I can
share.
Oh, perfect. Awesome. So as you can see here, across all our different settings, so Germany, the UK, Israel, Malaysia, Singapore, we really tried to give some examples across activities within and across different levels of the social ecological model that we felt would be informative to really think about best practices of health promotion, disease prevention, and really ideas for the future, right? What we can do well, and examples. And so next slide, please.
One second. It's going to take a minute. Sorry.
No worries.
For some reason, snap push. Okay, there we go.
Perfect. So as you see the little picture there up in the corner of the examples of the areas that we talked about, that's me with the introduction and just a little brief, get you in the zone. And then we're going to really delve into different examples within these levels. So Dr. Jill Rollins will talk about mental health promotion in primary care during COVID-19 as examples of how organizational and interpersonal levels work together within the social ecological model. Then Dr. Luis Nunez Saboca. Sorry, it's late. Sorry, Luis, you can do it better than me anyway. We'll talk about community level health promotion, school health promotion during COVID-19, really think about how the community level can really impact our health and well-being together. And then Dr. Levin Zamir will talk about cross-cutting social ecological models with really policies across Israel around health promotion during that time and how they really use the different levels to try to build health promotion writ large for the well-being of the community and to reduce health disparities. And then we'll have some conclusions and recommendations by Dr. Christine Sorensen. And then we'll have some time for discussions and commentary from our colleagues, Tintin Tzu and Orkin Okan from Malaysia and Germany to really pull all the threads together. So I think it's gonna be a great session, really excited. Sorry, it's almost midnight here. So I'm fading a little bit, but I'll try to stay with you because hear all these speakers and so pleased to be with you there and have a wonderful day. Aloha.
Thank you so much, Satine. That was a wonderful introduction, and we're very excited to keep going. Thanks for staying up. And this is what we do in our global working group on health literacy, is that we work 24/7 around the clock. We hear time zones from everywhere. So let's go forward. And it is really my distinct pleasure to introduce Dr. Jill Rollins from Newcastle University, Health Literacy Health Promotion Champion, who will introduce herself maybe a bit more than I am, because then she can do it much more accurately as a general practice physician and a physician and contributing so much to health promotion. So Jill, over to you.
Lovely. And Diane, do you want to keep pushing the slide through for me and I'll just tell you when to?
My pleasure.
Is that all right? We'll see how that goes.
My pleasure.
Thank you so much. So hello, everybody. It's just an absolute joy to be able to talk with you. Really sad that I'm not in a beautiful Girona, but I'm in nearly as beautiful Newcastle, so that'll have to do. So I'm a general practitioner and family physician, and that's my first love, and my second love is health promotion. I'm also a researcher and teacher at Newcastle University, and my big focus there in the field of health promotion, of course, is health literacy. So I'm going to talk a bit about mental health and COVID-19 and our experiences in the UK and a flavour of what happened. And then some of the things that have come out of it from my perspective, some of which I think are very good. Next slide, please. Okay, and again, there's some animations in here. So as with everywhere, COVID-19 hit suddenly and very hard. So we had our first case in January 2020, and then it just escalated, and then in March 2020, slide please, we all went into quarantine. This is all a bit of a blur for me because at this time, that time, I was actually also suffering from COVID, which I can testify to being very unpleasant. Next slide please. So we very quickly went into social isolation, and again Diane. One of the things that became apparent very, very quickly was the strain this was putting on people's mental health and the risk, the escalating risk of mental illness that was rising. It was an epidemic of mental illness that was developing in parallel To the physical epidemic of COVID. There was a constant stream of really distressing negative news. People were either sick themselves, or they knew friends and family members who'd been sick. They suddenly couldn't go and see their mothers and grandmothers in old people's home. I couldn't touch people in general practice. And for me, that was one of the key things, because touch to me is a core part of what I do. And suddenly I wasn't with my patients. I couldn't touch my patients. And the whole thing was really, really distressing. Next slide. So the National Health Service swung quite rightly into crisis mode. There was a huge focus on diagnosis. Next slide. Stop.
I'm pushing it stuck on it. 9 seconds. Let's see. Okay. Little bit of patience.
Okay. So there's loads of animations.
Yes. Okay.
If it doesn't work, then I can share mine, Diane.
Let's see. It was doing okay.
There we go. So there was a huge push towards diagnosis. There was a huge push towards treatment and high intensity treatment in the health service and in intensive care units in particular. Next slide. I'm so sorry about all the animations, Diane. So what happened was that the mental health side of things really took a back seat. Next one, Diane, please. So the primary care aspects of that too were really, really diminished.
Oh, there you go.
There we go. Okay, little step.
Just added one here.
Worth waiting. Okay, so next slide, please. And this really is a new slide now. Okay, so what happened? So, you know, we still had all this mental distress. We were still in quarantine. We still had lots of social isolation. Next slide. What was, in terms of mental health, I think the key people in taking this forward was actually not the health service. I think we were reactive. We were still very much focusing on the physical side, but we have a very strong and vibrant community and voluntary sector in terms of mental health, and many excellent charities, most of which were set up by people who'd had mental health issues themselves or their families. And they really started saying, look, hang on, there is a mental health epidemic that's happening here, or a mental illness epidemic that's happening in parallel to the physical epidemic, and we need to listen to that. Next slide. And so that prompted the health service to step up, and particularly health services, both specialist mental health services, the community mental health team, the psychiatrists, the community mental health nurses, but also importantly, my own specialty of general practice and community care. Next slide. And one of the things also that I think was very noticeable was our royal family stepped up to the plate, and Prince William, who's second in line to the throne and will eventually become king, he's a young man, but he's also somebody who has got a great interest in and experience, of course, in mental health and the importance of mental health. So he was able to take a public platform and say, look, mental health is important. We're all finding this difficult. It's okay to not feel good mentally, and there are things you can do for yourself, but there are also services that are there to support you. Next slide. And this for me is where health literacy really started coming in, because there was a real challenge then with unprecedented levels of mental health needs and mental illness in the community. There was a real challenge about making sure that people had access to good information about mental health, what mental health is, what mental illness is, what you can do about it when you need to ask for help. We had to make sure that that information was available, that people could get hold of it, that it was available in a form that people could understand, that people were able to appraise it and see what relevance that information had for them in their life settings, capacity to talk about it with friends and family and the health service, and then capacities to act on it where and when that was relevant for them. So health literacy for me has been a thread right through this. Next slide, please. Okay, so lessons learned. So this has obviously been an enormous shock to everybody around the world. And it's been dreadful. And, you know, a lot of people have sadly lost their lives or been bereaved. So that there's some terrible, terrible things. But in terms of mental health, I think there are some very good things that have come out of it. And one of our challenges now, while we have the door slightly open in terms of mental health and mental illness, is to put a foot in that door and make sure it doesn't slam shut again. So here are some of the things that I think have come out of it that I hope we can take forward. So next slide, Diane. So one of the things that COVID has really highlighted in the UK, as in so many countries, is the entrenched health inequalities. Not only the physical health inequalities, you know, people from marginalised and deprived and socioeconomically deprived and challenged groups are more likely to get COVID, suffer badly with COVID and die from COVID. They're also much more likely to face mental health challenges, to develop mental illness, and find it more difficult to access the information and support they need. So this has shone a very sharp, bright light on this, and we have to make sure that we keep that light focused on this and do something about it. Next slide. I think I would argue, and I'm very interested to hear from anybody who disagrees with me, but I would argue that actually mental health literacy is improved. I think there is increased readiness to discuss mental health and mental illness, a recognition that mental health is different from mental illness, and you can do things to promote and increase your mental health. But also we are all at risk of mental illness, and there are things that can be done about that. And also capacity to discuss it. So interactive or communicative mental health literacy, I would argue, has really increased. I now get phone calls from people who 2 years ago would never have felt able to admit they had mental health problems, mental illness problems, and would certainly never have talked to me about it. And now they feel able to do that. And I think that's a huge step forward, and we need to maintain that momentum. Next slide. Great. I think there is also an increased understanding of the interplay of physical, mental and social health in a way that I've never seen before. So previously, I think your average GP certainly would have, we'd all been taught the mental health, rather the WHO definition of health as a, you know, a good physical, mental and social health combined. But a lot of people in the health service at least were focused on illness rather than health. And I think now there is a recognition that all three is important, that there's a difference between health and illness, and that they are all interlinked, and that if you have increased stress in one area, it's going to bleed over into the other areas. And I think there's an understanding of that both within the health service and also the wider community that there hasn't been before. And that is something we really mustn't lose. Has there been reduced mental health stigma? I would hope so, yes. I think time will tell as to, you know, once we are eventually through this, do we maintain these, do we build on these foundations, more healthy mental health foundations we have now, or do we slip back into our old habits? I would hope that mental health stigma has reduced and mental illness stigma has reduced. Next slide. And there's a need for working across wider society. And I think this is a lesson for the health service. I mean, the health service did what it had to do in terms of emergency physical care. But this mental health focus really started from the community. And then we responded to it, which I think was the right way round. So you can click through the next three or four animations. So we've got some very, very good charities and people who are working within the community and voluntary sector who have led us on this. And I think we need to do that. Next slide, Diane. As I've said, I think the health service needs to be in response and listening mode. We know about health literacy. We have to make sure that we are keeping the conversations going around mental health and mental illness, that we've got the information available for people, that we maintain this understanding that mental health can be promoted and there are things that you can do in order to promote your mental health. A recognition that all of us have times when our mental health is not so good, or we might even be tipping into mental illness, and the things that you can do to help yourself, but also the times when you need to talk to others. And as physicians and nurses, we have to be ready to respond to that. Final slide, Diane, and thank you so much. And I'm so sorry there were so many animations in this. The final thing is a little bit of royal stardust goes a very long way. And I would be very hopeful that, you know, that support and awareness would continue. So that's everything from me. It's been an honour talking with people. I'll put my email address in the chat so that people can get back to me if they wish to. I'm going to have to leave in the next sort of half an hour or so I won't be around for the discussion, but very helpful to pick up either discussion points in the chat now or to talk later by email. Thank you very much, everybody.
Sorry, thank you so much, Jill. That was really, really enlightening. There was a quick overview of the journey that you and so many others went through in understanding the issues of mental health literacy, mental health promotion, but you also helped us look at the organizational aspects and also interpersonal, which is so much an important part of the model that Teen showed us, what we all know, the social ecological model. So thanks, and stick around if you can. And if there's questions for you in the chat, I'm sure people have something to say about stigma and so much of that has been given attention during this year. So we're going to continue on at this point. And I'm very happy to welcome Dr. Luis Saboga Nunes. Let's see if I can pull up a slide. Hi, and Luis is with us. Very thrilled to have him with us. And he has many different titles and many different contributions to health promotion and health literacy over the years. So I'll let him introduce himself more specifically. So Luis, if you like, I can push your slides or you can share your slides as you wish. And welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Diana, maybe you could push my slides and I would just use a communication sign between us two. I put my hand up when it's
okay
to go to the next one.
I can see. Okay, but first, please introduce yourself with all of your amazing titles.
Thank you very much. Well, there is not much about introducing myself, except that saying that I'm very pleased to be with you. And the connection between health literacy and health promotion, it has been for so many years one of my most greatest focus, as I am president of the ILFA section on health promotion. And there we have been also trying to grasp how these two things get connected in this way so that we can move on with quality of life and well-being. So thank you very much, Diane. I think it's enough for presentations. Regarding the socio-ecological model that is the basis of our approach, we can see that there is a huge understanding that we are living in a complex world. And this complex world is not anymore somehow an experience where we look at what is going on and at the same time we try to look at the very small pieces of it. So Diane, please. And therefore, our consideration of these concepts make us look at the school as one of the most complex systems that we have. And looking from the socio-ecological perspective, then we could say that, yes, we can see here how the circumstances that affect children, particularly from low-income families, have a tremendous adverse effect on socioeconomically disadvantaged children in the future, not only now, but in the future of our society. So we can move on, please, Diane. Can you see my hand? Yeah. So we could look at this from 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 wings, okay? So please, for these different wings, we can see that there are different perspectives where we can get in to the complexity of the system. So we can change it. And the first one would be intersectorality. And from this perspective, we could say that at least 4 domains come into perspective. The first one is policies, structures and systems, human resources and practices that we find in the everyday life of our health and school system. So one of the problems that we have faced is that somehow during the last years, the perspective of health promoting schools have been eroded. And we have separated the educational system from the health system. And it is one of the points that now we have somehow paid very heavily in our everyday practices. The second wing that I would like to propose that we look at is the one of the perspective that we bring in, please Diane, the next one, the perspective that we bring in from sustainability. So when we look at sustainability, we need to focus on the fact that there are practices that are somehow putting into question the sustainability of our systems, and in this case, the school system. And I will mention maximizing educational achievement. The issues of inclusion and equity are really creating an issue on intersectorality dash sustainability. Please, Diane. And from here, creating an environment that can be promoting and favorable to student development, and how these policies can move on, can be achieved, somehow help us to understand that many of these perspectives are facing huge issues. For instance, working parents may not have the time and resources to support their children. In some families, school closures and digital communication learning has been the only option for education and school health promotion. And if you look at the curriculum that we can find in these schools or in these school systems, you will see that very little is dedicated to health promotion per se. So children therefore must be provided with the necessary digital infrastructures and skills if we want to consider the sustainability of the process. And therefore creating this digital infrastructure is always a huge issue for those families that are in need of needs. So this requires an overall infrastructure to ensure that all families have capacities at their disposal and that teachers receive the necessary training and the availability of an emergency strategy for education. And this was not in place, of course. We were not planning and preparing for this before. But once the first wave came in, and we could look at how sustainable our systems could face this first wave, we started to see real how the big failures were popping up the way that we were not expecting them to be so tremendously affecting our children. So looking forward in the complexity of this perspective, I would like now, please, Diane, the next one. I would like now to look or consider with you how policies have been put into place. One of the issues that we can now start to understand is that the issue of equity has been maybe one of the most critical ones, because these policies that have been put into place in some countries, I would pick up, like, for instance, either Germany or Portugal or many other examples that we could pop up here, many policies have exacerbated pre-existing inequalities, and this has impact heavily on child development. So many children lack the necessary resources to ensure the participation, for instance, in distant learning processes. Many families just only have one computer, and the use of this only one computer very often doesn't meet the criteria that are needed to access infrastructures in order to support their process of educational achievements. So moving on now, we would like to make this perspective articulated with the community. So you see, when we look at how the school health issue has been articulated in the context of the community, the closures of schools and the barriers that have been come up in our everyday lives show that educational institutions and children did not receive the benefits of school health promotion. We could even say that in some countries, school health promotion was almost absent of this integration between school and communities. So the benefits that include high quality learning and educational opportunities, guiding from teachers and health professionals, access to digital infrastructures, the issue of school meals, the physical and sport activities, social and cultural capital, access to school community and peer contact. All these, and we could just only name some of it, all these show as how important the role of the community could have been highlighted during this time of pandemics. Please, the next one, Ben. And when we try to see how some lessons, how we could start to draw some perspectives to deal with crisis preparedness in the future, I would like to call your attention to several documents that are there now, very good quality, and it's incredible how they were produced in so short time. The one from the UNESCO Chair of Health Promotion Education, Ecole, Écrit Sanitaire. This is not yet in English, but I'm sure some of you can read French and you would find here very, very interesting hints. And also WHO has put it out several documents, but let us try to be synthetic here. First of all, we need a curriculum revision. So we have not make health promotion a topic in our educational systems. So every school should be the foundation of our healthy lives. And this would be one of the most interesting preparedness perspective that we could have. Second one, the intersectoral approach. We need to bring together education and health again. This was very highly put in the 80s and 90s, and somehow it started to be eroding in all of our decisions and policies, etc. So we need to bring this back. Health education, health rights, health duties, message and recommendations about good health behaviors must be integrated in the curriculum. Equity in transition to and from remote education is a very, very critical issue. Even for those families that have the capacity to provide their children with these resources. Even there, a lot of work has to be done. So supporting moving to an online learning environment and how the digital divide must be surveilled and must be mitigated is a critical issue today. I would just add another one, and the time is running out. I'm sure that all of you can bring very interesting ideas into this discussion. So support and sustain the critical needs. And you know, in some countries, we are dealing with school feeding and water supply for these children. And we need to take into consideration the role that schools have been playing in this area. Sanitation, of course, violent surveillance, hygiene, essential equipment. Just this morning, just to finish with an example, my wife, she's working as a physical teacher, and she was just telling me, yeah, in the beginning, for 2 days, we have these carpets with these hygienic products where children would walk in before getting into the classes, and we needed to clean all the material of that we were using before each class. That lasts 2 days. After that, there were no more products to continue this IGN essential equipment to be prepared for the next class. So you see, it's very good to have good ideas, but then we need policies to implement those ideas. I would say that this is where we are standing today. There are very good ideas up there. Yes, but health promotion is more than good ideas. Health promotion and linking health literacy to all this is much more than just writing down some papers and some documents. We need and we must urgently move into action. So thank you very much, Diane, for your support, and I'm happy to continue discussing these topics later.
Thank you, Diane. Thank you so much, Louise. And I really sense the transition from Jill's presentation on mental health literacy into the issue of children, schools, and families, where again, you know, what really emerges here is also many mental health needs as well. So continuing with our overview, not only of the different layers of the socio-ecological model, but also the different needs within it. So thank you. We do have a question in the chat for Jill before she hops off, and then we'll go take questions for maybe one question for Louise. Continue with our next presentation, our discussions. Our conclusions, discussions, and more discussions. So there's a question from Verna McKenna. Thank you, Jillian, for these really important insights. In addition to recognizing the importance of mental health needs in relation to COVID pandemic, I think it's also relevant to emphasize the importance of mental health promotion for people who are managing chronic illness. Is it something you see in your practice? So over to you, Jill. Can you give a response to this question by Verna?
Yes. So hello, Verna. Nice to be in contact again. I think this is really important, and I think this is something that's been increasingly recognised in the health field. So you know, we've learnt, for instance, you know, to screen people with chronic physical conditions for their mental health. But I don't think there's the public discussion of that. And it's public discussion in relation to mental health and COVID which has really taken things forward. So I think that we need a public discussion in relation to this really specific thing, because I don't think there is a public community understanding about just how the body, the mind, and the social setting are all interlinked. And people who are living with a chronic physical illness and all the stresses and strains that brings in all aspects of their lives, I don't think there's this sort of real community public understanding about how mental health goes hand in hand with that, and people feel like they're failing if they say, well, actually, you know, I feel absolutely dreadful, I'm really depressed, my, you know, heart disease stops me from going out and doing all the things I want to do, etc., etc. So in the same way that the public discussions in relation to mental health and COVID were led by our colleagues in the community voluntary sector, I think this discussion needs to come from them. And I think one of perhaps having sort of trumpeted the strengths of that sector, and they are huge strengths, I think one of the issues is that the charities are set up in relation to specific conditions. So there are the mental health charities, there are the heart charities, there are the diabetes charities, etc. And actually, maybe getting them together and actually talking together about how, if you've got mental health problems, you're more likely to get, for instance, heart disease. If you're living with heart disease, you are more likely to have mental health problems. I think having that public discussion and then having the health service ready to react to it when all this unmet need is identified and people feel able to come forward, I think that's probably the next frontier. And I think once we start to emerge blinking into the post-COVID dawn, then I think that's got to be right at the top of the public discussion. And I think the health service, we have to get ourselves ready to respond to that, so that when people actually say, ring me up saying, I'm really struggling, my diabetes is badly controlled, I can't leave the house, I've had to give up my job, I'm feeling really depressed, making sure that we have the capacity to be able to react and support them. So thank you very much for that. I think that's really important.
Thank you, Jill, for your perspective. That was really helpful. And there's so much more to say about all this. So transitioning from Louise's wonderful presentation about the needs and also some of the solutions that began to be developed for schools and families and children, I'd like just to take it forward with our experience, again, looking at the socioeconomic model, but kind of cross-cutting, because we have a systems, we always think about systems approaches in health literacy. Of course, the Ottawa Charter encouraged us to do so. So I'm pleased to just to share some of our experience in Israel, which as a small country, we're able to work as much as possible for systems approach, also because of the type of institutions and the healthcare system that we have. So it's a pleasure to be here with you. Also, this is an opportunity also to share that if we are in the IUHP now, just for all of you who are here, you might not know that there is a global working group on health literacy. So many of you on this group have also been very instrumental in initiating and leading. Jill is the current chair, previous chair. Christine has been one of the most important, you will hear from her soon, and Louise, one of the most important members that we've had, who are carrying the torch from here and beyond. So just to share with you where we've come. My slide will, that was backwards, sorry. Let's see if we can go forward. So as mentioned, we have we're talking about Corona. If you saw my last slide, I don't want to flip too many slides because we might get too confused. If you saw them, the director of the Department of Health Education and Promotion for Clalit Health Services, it's Israel's largest health service organization, and I've been working for 40 years in health promotion, health literacy, and health education. But then came Corona, and it really, really changed all of our perspectives of what we do. It was the first time in my experience that we had an emergency situation that wasn't military, that was a pandemic. And it really, the journey began, and we kind of had to revisit everything we know and everything we do, health promotion, health literacy, and all. So just to remind us the timeline, I think our timeline was mainly very much coinciding with many of your timelines of what happened in the past year and a half. And we began in February last year was announcing of the first coronavirus. I can say that I was with Christine and others in Copenhagen, and I think it was February 15th that year. And we were seeing some cases a little bit in China and maybe getting a little bit into Italy, but everybody was saying it won't go further and you don't need to use masks. And so this is where we began, and look how far we've come. In March we had, of course, the emergency, state of emergency, we had to close. We have had three different periods of closure. We had, and I'm going to go fast forward through the year, September, December, when we began the vaccination. That was the big change, the game changer. when Faten this morning mentioned the issue of resilience, it really resonated with me about our experience of where health promotion, health literacy has come and health supported. And everything changed with vaccines. And I'm happy to report, as I mentioned, maybe some of you heard in the beginning, today's June 15th, and Israel has put out a directive saying no more masks inside institutions. So we'll see if that holds. We hope so. So, but what happened in the beginning? And we had to really quickly change gears and go back to where we used to go for getting health information out as soon as possible, because there wasn't enough coming out, not of CDC and WHO and all. So our journey began with just getting as much information that was evidence-based, reliable, accessible, and answer the questions as much as we can. So we put out information sheets on care for children, for elderly, for self-care, for chronic disease, smoking cessation. What do you do during this period when there's smokers? Pregnancy and breastfeeding. Can you do that when there's COVID in the air, in the neighborhood, in the family? Physical activity, because people were home and quarantined, we wanted to keep them active. What happens when people are COVID positive? What is the self-care? How do we manage media exposure for children? And this has all had to be done culturally appropriately, because we have Hebrew and Arabic, and for new immigrants and ultra-religious. So this was a huge test. So we went back to our health education, health information, and basic health literacy that we were all trained in and we've all been doing, but this was really the focus. But at the same time, our policymakers were speaking out. This happens to be a very old picture, and if you who are following Israel politics know that Benjamin Netanyahu, who was the prime minister, that he 2 days ago became the former prime minister. After 12 years, we have a new one. But he was one of the first spokespeople. As you could see, he was talking about the way in which COVID could spread. We had the director general, and we had the minister of health, who himself was ultra-religious. And the language that came out was language that was not necessarily familiar to people: mitigating, exacerbating, additive effect, comorbidity, being vigilant, corona positive and negative. And recall that positive and negative doesn't always mean something good and bad. So we had to make sure that their language was language that we could connect the public to, flattening the curve. I think by the end of the year, anybody and everybody knew what that was. Trying to bring humor into what we were speaking about during COVID. And none of this we were prepared for ahead of time. This was really a work in progress. And then advocacy. We wanted to make sure that health promotion of the elderly, for physical activity during the work done. We wanted to make sure that we had places of worship that were respecting religion, but also not spreading COVID. So we had to speak up when different rabbis or different imamim were saying, come to us and we can gather and the Almighty will be protecting us. We had to engage them in discussion and ask them to rethink this and work with us as public health and health promotion people. We had challenges for our action. Up until then, we had thousands of people in groups, because in health promotion, we also do group work, and we had to immediately transfer it to digital. And I'll mention something in a minute just about that. So that was a quick change. We had not been prepared for that. We didn't even have the platform to do that. And by April, we had Passover, Ramadan, Easter came, and these are family gathering holidays. So we had to make sure that we were able to encourage people to keep their celebrations, but only in the immediate family. And for a society like Israel, doesn't matter what religion you are, this was a very difficult task. And then the social media and health issues came up in a positive way, but also in a way that we were challenged by making sure that we were looking, hopefully helping the public look at this critically with the infodema. So, and then the question of a mask. This was only halfway through. We had a mask was introduced, and there were different types of masks. How to use a mask? Should you use a mask? What does it mean as far as being, was it patronizing? Were we able to allow people to decide or not? So all these questions came up as far as, you know, public trust and whether or not anybody who was leading was actually telling us what was something that we wanted the public to know. And of course, you all know the issue of infodemics. And I'm just giving you a few quotes from WHO, because it was a huge challenge for us. You know the definition. I don't have to read it to you, but we're actually dealing with it still today. And critical health literacy is so important as a skill. And we also want to make sure that we were actually answering the questions, but first getting the right answers. And from some of you might remember that there was questions about can a hair dryer or sun exposure or wait for the summer. Any of people were looking for anything that could help them, help us have hope. And there was an issue of hope that was a kind of a thread. The first lockdown, people had hope. The second and third, people were very distraught. And it was very difficult to keep the lockdown going. So this, but there were opportunities here. And just to wrap up this part, I want to make sure that we also remember when there is a crisis, when there is a challenge, it's always an opportunity. So for example, we have active communities, digital communities for chronic patients. It's called Kamoni, like me. And they've been in existence for 10 years in Israel. So this was their time to shine and to bring active communities together online to support each other, because they were there already, but they were able to actually take the lead. So they were working very hard at keeping people together and they had keeping discussions going, whether it was in Hebrew, whether it was in Arabic. Also, we had quarantine hotels, maybe you did in your countries as well. So we were able to, it was a new health promoting setting. So we were able to digitalize in some of our champions to talk about sexual health, family health, and all through a Zoom, a group Zoom, and have town meetings with them. So there's an opportunity to have a new setting that we had never had before. As I mentioned before, our digital, our in-person workshops became digital. And that was something I had wanted to do for 3 years. And Corona brought the opportunity. We were supported to be able to have a huge platform now with Microsoft Teams and have workshops every night. There's 20 to 30 parallel workshops online, even though we pretty much touch, what did we say, come out of COVID on smoking cessation, nutrition, childbirth, parenting, breastfeeding, diabetes, self-care, and now coping with long haulers for COVID. So every evening we have just dozens of workshops, and we're maintaining that even though the in-person workshops have opened up in our clinics. So we have now employee health and Corona that we also were able to keep that going. I'm gonna just highlight here this, we either did it in person or had people Zoom in from home because many of them were also work lockdown. And finally, just to mention the seniors gone digital, I've called this, and so much public and private partnership for promoting digital health literacy and digital health and digital opportunities for 60, 65 plus. We know the issue of loneliness. We know the issue of the need to connect, particularly to connect also with the health system, which, as you know, in Israel, we have a startup nation, but we also know that not everybody is familiar and feels comfortable with it. So this was an opportunity to really take it forward, and we're maintaining it now. So we call it more the digital development and not digital divide. And finally, as you know, vaccines came in and that changed everything for us. But we had a health system, we have health system infrastructure in place, leadership and workforce recruitment really was able to promote vaccine acceptance. Otherwise, we would not have been able to get the coverage we did. Strength coming in numbers. We were fortunate to get the number of vaccines because we early on, our leadership jumped on board because we had such high rates of COVID. The technology was familiar. So any of you know diffusion of innovation is a model for health literacy and health promotion. The vaccines were familiar. So the technology wasn't an issue. But here's solidarity. And this is something we'll have to explore more, not just in this session, but beyond this throughout the next few days, and keep it going for health promotion, health literacy, because it was one thing that was tapped into the society, bringing people together to prioritize who should be getting the vaccine and to respect that, and keep the health literacy, health information, cultural appropriateness going throughout all of this. So this was our experience, and there's so many conclusions we could be drawing from all of our experience together. And I'm just happy to keep the ball rolling and to invite Christine Sorensen, a health literacy champion that many of you know, to have the perspective of these three different case studies, and in the article we wrote together and beyond, we put together some conclusions and recommendations that we'd like to present now before having our wonderful discussants give their perspectives as well. So Christine, welcome.
Thank you so much. And also thank you for sharing your experiences. We met indeed last year in March, and so much has happened since then. So it was fabulous to see what Israel has done and also the other cases. So my name is Christine Sorensen. I'm the founder of the Global Health Literacy Academy and also president of International Health Literacy Association and in the IHP working Global Working Group on Health Literacy. And to really summarize all the lessons learned that was put forward today, we focused on four areas we would like to relate to our policy advice, building on equity and trust and system approach and sustainable action. And equity has turned out to be a really important issue. Although we know from our research that much research on health promotion and also in healthcare in general, that health is unevenly distributed, it became even much more clear during the pandemic that the system is under pressure, people are under pressure, the public is under pressure, that those who are in vulnerable conditions, we should be aware to be taken care of. And not all countries manage to do that as well as others. We did hear some examples today on how this can be done. Diane, that is one of your major concerns in your work, how to adapt and translate material very rapidly into different languages and different cultural settings, and we can learn from you. In terms of public trust, this is not something that can be build up while we're under in a pandemic. It's something we need to make sure that is there already when emergency strikes. And we do see that those countries that have already a high public trust, for example, in the country where I come from, Denmark, in Scandinavia, there is a high public trust. So we quite easily adapt to the messages from authorities in an emergency situation, because during non-emergent situations, we believe in what they're telling. We also know that in other countries, there is much political discussion and much diversity, and therefore public trust is something that needs to be taken care of from the very beginning. And it might not be as easy as hoped for, but it goes for both the public as well to be critical and to speak up when they see unfair things, as well as decision makers to take that responsibility to not contribute to mis and disinformation, as was mentioned by several of you. Third point was our system approach, and we have seen examples today on how that can be done. It's not only in healthcare, it's also the school settings, community development. And it's about also looking at all aspects of health. The pandemic focused very much on the symptom and more like biological, biomedical aspects of the disease in the beginning, but we did quickly see that also social health matters, and not at least mental health that Jill Rowlands was talking about. So in the future, we need to ensure that there is a preparedness system in place that captures all aspects of health, even financial health, because many people were threatened regarding employment and safe working conditions. Lastly, our sustained action is a call for political planning and even also evaluation. And when we look through our Danish contingency plans, and some municipalities were pulling out the contingency plan from the drawer, it showed that it said there was a phone number they could call to order more masks. But of course, in a pandemic, you cannot just call the phone number to your normal delivery, because there was such a global demand, and it was almost like the Wild West about stealing masks from planes and all what we heard about. So we need, I think that's one of the major lessons learned, that this was a global pandemic, and therefore suddenly whatever happened elsewhere would impact even local institutions on how they could order more material. And it's also about fairness in distributing resources. So next slide, please. So it's really about how do we adapt to future challenges? How do we build and learn from the best practices? Our discussions is a one way forward to share and speed up the knowledge dissemination. It's about building systems where we can rely on the data and also, as I said, logistically develop the distribution when we have the data and we have identified problems, then how can it be solved? Right now during the pandemic, we were basically building the plane while flying, but I think we should also not underestimate this big endeavor. It was like flying to the moon, and so many people across the world, from research to the development to decision makers to public, have contributed that this is indeed a success, and that now we have vaccines and we are actually over the emergency phase and now tackling and managing the situation. So this is one way to also build in our mindsets that this can happen again. And it was interesting to learn from our colleagues in Asia who had actually been through the SARS and MERS, that they were in front of many other countries because they had learned from the experience 10 years ago, and they had mobilized and prepared their systems that this can happen, and it did happen, and therefore their populations knew what to do, and the systems were prepared also to enhance health literacy, even if it was a challenging and very difficult context to navigate in. So lastly, it's really a call for humanity, as we have seen here, where everyone plays a role, the small decisions that we take in everyday life and that we can convey through health promotion messages, where we focus on empowerment and we focus on, of course, there are rules and regulations, but it's also about being sensible in the situation and not do any harm. We did see examples of people following the harms and following the procedures, and they actually did harm to children. For example, some people could not were allergic to detergent, and you had, you know, crying children. But that even though the staff was putting detergent on them because that was according to the rules, I think what we are aiming at through health promotion is really that everyone stand up in an emergency and do whatever it takes in their surroundings, that within a few meters, you are the boss and we are the people to take decisions. We cannot rely on higher levels decision-making process and before it filters down again. We are all there to play a role. So it calls for humanity, it calls for creativity, and all the cases we have seen today definitely show that this is the art as well as the science of health promotion that can improve health also in a pandemic. Thank you so much,
Christine. And these reflections are so important for getting us prepared for the next, whenever it would be, and not just wait to have to be reactive. So I'm really, really excited to invite two of our really close colleagues who have contributed so much to this discussion throughout the past year, and but way before as well, on health promotion and health literacy. And first, I'd like to just stop sharing and invite Tintin Su, Dr. Tintin Su from the School of Medicine and Health Sciences from Monash University in Malaysia, for a few minutes of giving us her perspective. And then over to Dr. Okan to give us his perspective as well. So I'm going to see if we can spotlight you. Tintin, can you open your camera? Are you with us here?
Yeah.
Hi, there you are. Good. Hi, Tintin. She's coming in from Malaysia. I know this is a European conference, but look how lucky we are. We've had from Hawaii, we've had Malaysia, and then from Europe itself. So Tintin, what do you think about all that we've said? Your work has been so focused on vulnerable populations as well. So can we get you some of your perspectives on what's been presented and about your work?
Thanks, Diane. Thanks for a nice introduction. So in doing digital wall, everybody can participate and everybody can communicate. So it's not surprising someone from Malaysia participates in the European conference, but I wish I could be in physically in this place. It would be so much, you know, wonderful. Actually, I would like to echo what Christine mentioned and then what our colleague presented during the presentation. Selection of the case studies from Israel on general population and UK primary care in Germany, elderly and school health, clearly demonstrated the challenges in real world action for health promotion intervention, research and policy during COVID-19 pandemic. These case studies also highlighted the crucial role of health literacy in development of individual, interpersonal, community and policy level intervention, reflecting to the socio-ecological models. I would like to add some information on the group of vulnerable population, like Diane's rightly mentioned, such as the migrant workers. So Malaysia, where I live and work, and Singapore, our close neighbor, are the main destinations for migrant workers in the region. So generally, migrant workers, we are left behind due to lack of attention given to promote health literacy according to their language and their cultural needs. And not surprisingly, they also have a limited access to health promotion service and opportunity like other vulnerable populations like elderly, people with underlying conditions and special needs, and people with low health and digital literacy. But the most crucial situation for the migrant workers are the structural inequality in health, such as their living condition, poor living condition with a high residence density, and then they have a higher likelihood of holding low paid occupations like working or job, which require high in-person contacts. And crowded dormitories and sharing of common facilities were identified as a root cause of the COVID-19 spread during first wave of pandemic. The poor living condition and environment prevented them from practicing proper preventive measure. They might understand, you know, how to do physical distancing, how to keep hand hygiene, you know, but their environment, you know, does not allow them, you know, to practice. And then I found it, the COVID-19 pandemic reset what we are thinking and what we are practicing. So for migrant workers, you know, the focus is on policy and environment, environmental changes, together with individually oriented health promotion programs like hand hygiene, physical distancing, wearing masks. So actually the migrant workers are living in the poor living conditions, you know, we knew it, everybody knew it, but we just pushed aside and then didn't give, you know, much a priority. But this is, you know, COVID-19 is an alarming call, you know, because the health of health situation of the COVID migrant workers, you know, can turn into public health threats, you know, to the whole countries. So there are immediate measures we are taking, you know, like enforcement to dormitory operator to maintain hygiene on their premises, and then providing temporary housing used by using vacant public housing flat, and then using floating hotels, you know, any exhibition halls, whatever spaces, you know, available, you know, to use as a temporary housing, you know, for the migrant workers. But like Christine mentioned, you know, there should be a sustainability plan, you know. Finally, the Singapore government announced to build the new dormitories with a better facility to enhance physical distancing and hygiene practice. And similarly, Malaysia government also implemented a new law which require employers to provide proper accommodation for the migrant workers to prevent spread of the COVID-19. What I would like to highlight here is the layers of socio-ecological models such as individual, interpersonal, community, organization, and policies are not standalone. They are interconnected and they're cross-cutting. The Diane case on general population highlighted this fact as well. For the migrant workers to support individual behavior change, it is crucial to implement policies for enabling environments together with, you know, enhancing health literacy. So thank you very much, Diane and teams, you know, to give me opportunity to share my opinions, and then we shall further discuss in the audience participation section. Thank you. Thanks again.
Thanks so much. Again, we can't forget what's the issue of how disparities really emerged even more than I think many of us knew, and many think of the policymakers knew. And I think Corona, again, this COVID was one of the most important lessons learned that we have to take forward. So it is also my pleasure to invite our close colleague, Dr. Orkan Okan from Bielefeld University in Germany, who will also give us his perspective and from his expertise and all the work he's been doing over the year and before, and he will be doing on health promotion, health literacy, and COVID. So, Orkan, over to you.
Thank you so much, Diane. And unfortunately, due to a conflicting workshop that I had together with the colleagues from UNESCO Chair Education and Health, I couldn't attend the first hour of this workshop. So I have unfortunately missed all the interesting presentations that came from our publication last year, the Health Promotion Preparedness, but health literacy was added to it as well. And therefore, I would just like to show two, three of my slides very briefly that I had presented in the other workshop on the Global Alliance on Health Literacy in Schools, and thereby also highlight the relevance of health literacy in the current pandemic. So build up upon what Christine just reported and also give a very brief glimpse to this alliance in school. If that's okay, Diane.
Right. Great. And then we will, with the last 5 minutes or so, wrap up with
right.
some
I will make
questions.
It very, I will make it very brief.
Yeah, we're running a little bit late, but if people can stay on a little bit afterwards, that'll be great. Thanks.
So what you see here is the German mandatory digital education curriculum, which is providing a media literacy framework. So you can see it's digital education, and within digital education, Germany addresses media literacy. This concept is now mandatory from the next school year on, beginning after the summer closes. And what you see here, information and seeking skills, this is reflecting pretty much the health literacy core components. And in our many of our projects and also in the Alliance, we thought that since this is already in the school, this is a mandatory part of the curriculum, teachers are trained during their training in this concept, we could use this to address health literacy and have developed an intervention. And other than the health literacy core component, information and seeking skills, we can see here, I put a picture here of NutBeam's concept, functional interactive critical health literacy, which is pretty much reflected by these three elements. And so offers more entry points even for a health literacy. And since we know that these days, especially during the COVID-19 pandemic, most of the information and communication interaction on coronavirus happens on social media, on internet, you can see these dimensions. Hardware use, digital tool use, data protection, algorithms, modeling, that here are very, very important concepts that are very useful to health literacy and can be used. So you see, this is a concept that we have now in Germany in place, and we started using it in order to strengthen health literacy. I will skip this. What you see here is some information on the Global Alliance for Health Literacy in Schools. And last year in Germany, we have launched the German Alliance for Health Literacy in Schools. In Germany, we have a ministry-led alliance on health literacy like some other countries. And we decided that we have to do something similar within that alliance to address the education sector. And together with various ministries, education, health, social affairs, etc., school networks, school association, and a lot of researchers, practitioners, and policymakers, we have launched this and also published our vision paper last year. And the aim of our alliance is to work on health literacy sustainably together with the education sector. And in doing so, we have established a lighthouse project. I am not sure if this translates adequately to English, but lighthouse in German, of course, it's the lighthouse, but it also means this is an example that shines for others. Our aim is to gather 100 schools in Germany using this whole of school and community health literacy framework and implement it in their setting. And in this context, we have partnered with the Lions Foundation, which is a globally operating foundation on life skills, mostly in schools, and will include our concept of health literacy to their programs. And in the other workshop where I just came from, we have introduced the Global Alliance for Health Literacy, because we want to do the same thing that we are doing in Germany internationally. And if you are interested, here are the email addresses. Just post an email and we will take you on board this alliance. And we know that, I'm just stopping the presentation now. And we know that health literacy is so important these days for during the COVID-19 pandemic, and it's important to address it in school and in children and adolescents, but it's not that easy. And this is an opportunity to streamline some of the capacities and bring the actors together globally who are interested in doing that. So it's a specialized field within the health literacy field.
Thank you so much for that, Arkan. I think it's another silver lining, the conclusion that we have, that people have come together to see the needs that maybe otherwise would not have received attention during COVID, and that is going to be carried on beyond. So thank you for that. I'm also happy that we were able to see some of the work you did in the parallel session, because we weren't able to participate. It was kind of double booking. So just before we open up for Q&A, let me just, if we have time, before I forget, I don't want to forget, I want to let you all know that we're having a global summit on health literacy from the 3rd to the 5th of October. Christine mentioned that she's a president of the International Health Literacy Association, and many of us have come together to work together to have our first summit. So this is the website, and please go ahead and register and participate. It will be virtual, coming out of Taiwan. But I'm going to come back, and I'd like to hear from others, some of you who have you've participated and have stayed with us from the beginning of the session, questions, perspectives, issues, points of debate that you might have. We actually had presented this as a workshop. We'd submitted as a workshop, but it was accepted as a symposium, which is a bit less interactive, but we still wanted to keep the flavor of a workshop. So issues that you would like to bring up, questions, comments, whether we call the workshop an oral session or a symposium or whatever, we'd like to hear from you and any of your opinions about what we presented. Do you agree that national policies have to include preparedness also for health promotion and health literacy or not? Do any of the points that were brought up from any of our presenters, would you like to pick up on them? Do you have questions about them at all? So we just have 2 more minutes, and I'm willing to stay on as well if anybody would like to. So if I may, I would like to ask, I would like to pose a question if I can to our speakers. I would like to, music is coming out of you. I'd be really interested in understanding the way in which maybe some of the policymakers or some of the decision makers in your organizations will not maybe not go as far as the politicians. And what was the reaction and what was the interest you took in health promotion during the pandemic vis-a-vis your work in public health and health promotion? Was it something you had to be proactive about, or were you there when you were referred to reactive? How did that dynamic go? Can anybody share that personal experience with us? Not sure where there's ringing going on. I'm gonna try to, okay, thank you. How did it go for you, Tintin? And you work in the university, and you work in public health. Was the issue of contributing your expertise during COVID for health promotion, for public health, was it something that you were able to, that you needed to be proactive about? Or was it something that the decision makers called on experts in public health and health promotion to contribute to what was the big challenges in COVID How did the dynamic work? If you could just share with us a minute or two.
Yeah, definitely, Diane, you know, because like I said in my discussions, you know, the COVID-19 reset, you know, what we are thinking, what we are doing, you know, so and currently we are working, you know, mostly from home and then dealing with, you know, a lot of issues, you know, so health promotions, you know, before going to the communities, you know, we start, you know, doing some health promotion activities, you know, in the university. So staff, you know, academic staff, you know, students, you know, and changing a lot of lecture to a digital platforms, you know, make a lot of stress and work from home, you know. So there are a lot of mental health promotions, you know, programs in the universities. And then there are several employee assistance, you know, program in the university. So they did invite the professionals in the university to do a consultation, you know. And particularly I'm holding one of the research platforms, the community cohort, you know. So our initial interventions, you know, a lot of face-to-face interventions are converted, you know, into digital interventions and working with the people in low and middle income country, slow health literate and digital illiterate, you know, we have to put, you know, a lot of efforts, you know, to reach our health promotion activities to the community. But generally, I think the government agency, universities, NGOs, you know, they are quite supportive, you know, even we are, a lot of meetings are in the digital platforms, you know, we can still continue working, you know, not like as usual, but, you know, we can still keep on going our health promotion activities. Did I answer your question,
Yes,
Diane?
You did. Thank you. So you're saying that you applied all of your skills and your expertise to your immediate community, which was fabulous as well, which I think many of you also did. I see Stefan Vandenberg is here, and I see other experts here who also became active. We all had to change gears about what we did as well. So, and thank you, Tintin. Other perspectives, if Louise, if you would like to give any more perspectives from your work and from your vision, your Trojan horse vision, or any other vision that you have or conclusions you have about this period or anybody else who is on this symposium / workshop.
Hey, thank you, Diane. I think this is a good opportunity to link each other's experiences and try to learn with each other's. Although we live in the digital world, somehow some good experiences have stayed in very local areas and not spread around the world. And I would like to suggest that somehow after this moment that we are together sharing ideas, experiences, whatever, we initiate a system or a process or whatever you want to call it, where we could really grasp the good practices, how they were implemented and how in different countries obstacles were put aside to move on. What I can see in certain areas of Europe, at least that's where I'm a little bit more aware of, is that there is fatigue, people are tired. The energy that is needed to make creativity, new things with our creativity, somehow went into face the pandemic, strength and issues that somehow we were not able to cope with. And this, I would say, that is one of the reasons why we have to unite. We have to connect very, very strongly in order to move on to the next world that we are all expecting to come in very soon. So I would put the issue that we need a very strong partnership and connectivities and networks, whatever we want to call it, with the students, with the teachers, because somehow we have not heard their voices. They have just been the object of our actions, and they are not the makers of the solutions.
Thank you. So the issue that came up in the opening session on citizen participation, not just citizen and non-citizen participation, whether they're adults, children, adolescents, big challenge for us. And I think we realized how difficult that task might be, particularly in the period for COVID, but your insights are really important. And I think I'd like to also just once again, resonate again the topic of and remind us that we will keep coming together, and this will be for the summit, and Tintin's also been active in this and many others to put the summit together, and we'll look forward to keeping the discussion going in all of our conferences and our discussions between conferences. Here's an opportunity to come together. And just picking up on Louisa's points, let's keep the discussion going. You mentioned to capture the good practice that took place during COVID, have a compendium. Our article was kind of a first step, but we have to learn more. So let's try to do that and have the silver lining, keep the positive aspects of quality of life, health promotion, health literacy that were launched, initiated during this year, to keep it going beyond. So with that, I thank you all. It's been a pleasure to be with you, even though it was a little bit of a rocky start. It took us a few minutes to everybody find their room. So we lost about eight to 9 minutes. But so thank you for staying on beyond the hour. And I look forward to seeing you in the rest of the sessions today, tomorrow, Thursday, Friday. And to keep in touch. So thanks very much. Thank you for the speakers. Appreciate it. I think we were told to do this and this. So thank you all very much.